Good morning and welcome everyone to our final week in Christian Hospitality for Troubled Times. I know you expected to see Dave Fetterman here. He's done a wonderful job of leading this series. He's moving this weekend because he's getting married soon. And so I think he's starting to get things in order before his wedding. And he asked Ted and me if we would take his notes and just simply moderate a discussion among all of you about what we've been talking about and this subject of how do we practice Christian hospitality, especially today in our community and our world. So I hope you'll all feel free to join in. The discussion can go in whatever direction we want it to be. We'll kick it off and then we'll just let it go wherever. Before we open with prayer, I'd like Bobby Hartman to introduce two very special guests we have with us.
I'd like to introduce our guests, Jessica and Jeff Bowman. They are from the Society of Brothers, which has been, more common name is the Brotherhood. I'll tell you about maybe 35 years ago, we visited there, and they were speaking of hospitality. They were hosts to us. And it was very formative in our Christian life, I have to say. I think to a large degree, the reason why we're here in this church at all is because of that group of people. And you guys want to stand up?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And please feel free to jump in. We want you to be a part of the conversation. Yeah, absolutely.
Please do jump in.
Yeah.
We're substitutes for a substitute.
Right.
So everybody's fine.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a rough month. Okay. For our opening prayer, I was inspired by Jim Gilchrist's sermon at 8:30, and if you haven't already been to the service, I think you'll find it really fits with our topic very well. And the middle hymn we sang kind of inspired his prayer, too, and it also inspired me. I looked at the description of it at the bottom of the hymnal, and it said that these words offer a reminder that the model for our dealings with others should be God's generosity rather than limited human tolerance. And I thought that was pretty powerful. The hymn is There's a Wideness in God's Mercy. It's just two verses long, and often we're so busy singing that we don't think about the text. So I'll read it as a prayer, because after all, hymns are sung prayer. There's a wideness in God's mercy, like the wideness of the sea. There's a kindness in God's justice, which is more than liberty. There's no place where earth's sorrows are more felt than up in heaven. There is no place where earth's failings have such kindly judgment given. For the love of God is broader than the measures of the mind, and the heart of the eternal is most wonderfully kind. If our love were but more faithful, we would gladly trust God's word, and our lives reflect thanksgiving for the goodness of our Lord. Amen. Okay, I'll get us started. I'm drawing on the book that Dave Fetterman based his work on, Christine Pohl's Making Room, Recovering Hospitality as a Christian Tradition. She is a Methodist professor in Kentucky at Asbury Seminary. And I've been digging in the book, and I think it's a really wonderful resource if you want to explore this topic further. Well-written, wonderful examples. But she talks at one point about how in today's society, we're all relative strangers. We deal with strangers all the time, at the grocery store, in restaurants. Most of the people we see in a day, we've never seen before, and we may never see again. And so we don't think much about it. I mean, we just accept these strangers as friends and people we know, even though they are strangers. But we think, yeah, those are people like us. But the people at a low economic level are vulnerable, for sure. Among these other people, some may be vulnerable. We don't know. It's hard to see. But the people we don't see who don't live in our neighborhoods are definitely vulnerable. And when we don't routinely interact with them, we tend to perhaps think they don't exist. Or it's just easy to ignore them. Especially, and this is what I found interesting, when the media shows us images of needy strangers from all over the world. Think about how when you watch TV or even on the internet, you're always seeing these pictures. Recently, refugees, but whatever, suffering from all over the world. You see the visual images. And what she thinks is this, and I will quote, "A steady exposure to distant human need that is beyond our personal response can gradually inoculate us against particular action. It can also delude us into thinking that by simply knowing about it, we are somehow sharing in the suffering of others. Isolation from local need and overexposure to overwhelming but distant need make our responses to strangers uncertain and tentative at best." So what do you think? John?
As with a mother's tender hand, gently leaves the chosen band. So when I came to the words of the chosen band, I sort of felt, well, if we say that, then we can just say, well, we're the chosen folks, and we don't need to worry about, you know, the others.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to say those words.
I think that comes from Isaiah and God's chosen people. I mean, it says that. And so, but I understand what you mean. We have to be careful that we don't consider ourselves the ones, yeah, chosen by God. That's difficult. Yeah. Well, yeah. So what about this? Strangers that we see from far away make us sort of think, oh yeah, all those refugees, I'm in support of those. Yeah, I'm helping them because basically I watch TV, I listen to the radio, I agree. Oh yes, but does that resonate with anyone? Yeah,
you have to admit though that there is a thread that's floating around now that doesn't say, you know, we want to help the refugees, that says they're not like us and they need to stay where they are, and the people from Mexico need to stay where they are, and every, you know, we have our own little country here and we like it the way it is, or we like it the way it used to be, and we don't want any of those people who are not like us to come here. And that is, I think, heresy. It's the worst. So I don't know if that's a comment you wanted, but
no, I think that's what you see in the political
sphere
in particular. And I suppose it's particularly bad when self-proclaimed Christians talk this way. Is that kind of what you... Yeah. I guess in this community of faith, we would like to think that that's not how we see it, but I don't know. Other ideas?
Thank you. I've heard this thread too, but what I think is we're a country of laws. That's by the nature of our Constitution and by the history of our country. And it was the way I grew up. And so I look at people and I say, you know, the whole country is made up of refugees in a lot of ways. I mean, we started with people mostly from Europe, but basically the Middle East, there are a lot of people came in that way, and I think we need to continue to have people come in. But we have a described method for people coming in. And I think if there's a way to bring refugees over and run them through the regular routine, fine. I don't condone mass people coming in under illegal methods or whatever methods are described to get large groups of people in from other countries. But I do subscribe to the fact that it's okay to have them come in. But let's have them come in under the described system of laws that we already have.
Okay. Okay. Any other ideas about the vulnerable among us, how we ignore them?
Jeff and I have been in the city since October, and just in a nutshell, and anybody can ask us more at a later date, but our church community in Farmington sent us here to the city really to follow the steps of Christ. And his hands working here in the city to learn, to encourage, to connect, and strengthen that however we can in bonding with all the different individuals and groups that are here working very hard, dedicated to better the lives of many, many people who do not have it so good. And something that goes through my mind that I think is very connected, and we've kind of wrestled with this often in different situations that we have come to meet in the city, is how do the words of Christ when he says, see if I get it right, when you do unto the least of these, you do unto me. And what does that mean to us as Christians? And that's a challenge for us. And it's just it's something that is working in us. What does that really mean?
And what does that, even more, what does that mean for us in the suburbs? That's what we struggle with, being in this kind of neighborhood where we do try to work some in the city, but what would you have advice about how to approach that challenge? That's something Bobby's always talking about.
I know. I think that sometimes we need to keep our eyes and ears open for what's going on in our own neighborhoods. You know, you don't realize many times because people aren't out in their yards making contact. You know, I feel like the people I know best in my neighborhood are the other people with dogs walking the dogs. You see what I mean? Or young families, the parents meet, or the mothers meet especially, when they're children, schoolmates. You know what I mean? But at a certain stages of life, I feel like it's hard to get to know who were your neighbors. And what if there are needs that need to be met? It might not be obvious.
In other words, not all need is economic. And vulnerable can apply in many different ways. And that's probably something our church, and I know it tries, but it can try harder to look within the community to find that need. what's behind those curtained windows, what's going on. Yeah.
And I would just add, consistent with what Dr. Pohl said, that when you are exposed to people as an abstraction, you know, these people on the television, these people, you know, that you see as an idea, as rather than a person, a precious child of God, it's more difficult. But I find that when people encounter you as a human being, when you encounter someone, most people respond well to individuals. But when you rush past a homeless person, well, I really don't want to consider this person as a human being because I just can't deal with it. It's easier to just make assumptions and move on. So I think that, and that goes back to the parable of the Good Samaritan. All those people that pass that person thinking, well, he must be unclean, he must, you know, have brought this on himself, this must be this person's story, and I really don't want to stop and immerse myself in this. I think really considering every person who is a child of God as an individual leads us to the right place.
More on that topic, yeah.
I have found driving to where people that we're describing live, that could be City Mission down in Washington that has 120 homeless people, or Homewood that a number of us are involved with. As Jim says, showing up is 95%. And the work that's being done there will provide all kinds of opportunities for other people in Westminster to get involved. And what I really believe is if you give somebody an opportunity to use what I call their career skills, things they're really talented at, in a meaningful way, that helps Homewood, that helps City Mission, they show up. And we're going to have plenty of those opportunities in the coming year.
I don't have an answer, but there's something we probably need to think about. Very often we look at things and think, well, how can I fix it? And it becomes an ego trip. And it's as if it's me doing these things. It's really God working through us, and that should give us confidence that, you know, whatever our capacities are, and some of us don't have a lot of capacities to do things, to actually change things, do what you can. Even in a small way, because if it's God working through you, this is a big plan. You're just a part of it. And we shouldn't forget that. And sometimes we pride ourselves with the great things we're doing, and it's all about us and our ego. That's really not the way to look at it.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to what the lady behind us said about how we often don't know our close neighbors. And I think it may be connected with the question that you raised about is there any advice for how to reach out to those who are the least of these. And what I'm thinking is that, you know, we met some refugees, my wife and I, recently. And one of the young men in the family was very sad that compared to how it was in Africa, where you knew everybody in your village, they don't know anyone on their street here in Pittsburgh. And I mentioned that to somebody, and he said, well, that's not really that surprising because most of the people on that street already probably didn't know each other. So it's not that they're specifically ignoring the refugees. So maybe what my wife and I have been thinking is what we need to do is to, on our own community, spend more time with the people who we don't know and start with that. And then when an opportunity would arise for someone who really is the least of these, then we'll be more able to respond, because we all have our friends. You know, Jessica and I have friends. I'm sure you all have your circle of friends who you maybe invite for dinner now and then, or go out to eat with. But what about the people we don't know? And that's just going through my mind, because we have a longing that the refugees really find a home here, but we may as well start with those who we don't know in our own area.
That's excellent, absolutely. Making connections and reaching beyond our habits. I think we're, as you say, we have our friends and we get stuck in a rut and something needs to jerk us out.
So,
before we move on, Heather had something.
Well, on our street, we get together for like New Year's Day at various times, and it's wonderful to catch up with people, and we have known them for a long period of time. But when somebody needs something, or we feel comfortable sharing and being with them, or whatever, and it's not as if they need anything. It is mostly the emotional support. Would you say just the camaraderie? Some people share football games and sports and stuff that I do, things like that. So, but we are, what I would think, we are neighbors. We do share with one another. We know one another. We make it a point to reach out to all the new neighbors who come. So, I think that's a start. Just getting together, just, you know, we had Christmas cookie exchanges, things like that. Just very kind of almost superficial. It starts, and then when we're out and about on the street or wherever, we're always, how are you doing? What's going on? And, you know, people lose their jobs and their wives go back to work or school or to nursing or whatever they're doing. But we know about them, and when they need help, we're there for them. And we celebrate with them when their kids go off to school and graduate from high school. So I think we do have a bond on our street, and I think it has been sort of a historical thing on our street, and it's just continued. But I do think it's a wonderful place to start.
So, another question for us to think about. We've talked about ways that we can be hospitable, and I think in the discussion we talked about how being hospitable also requires taking a bit of risk, or involves taking a bit of risk. Sometimes this hospitality is in a public setting, you know, like an event. In a public setting, it can still be personal. You can still make a personal contact. But the question I want to pose is it really personal? We do this a lot at Westminster, Produce of People, building together. I'd really be interested in everybody's reflections on how this public hospitality is effective and how it's not. Any thoughts?
Well, when you go with a group of when you go with a group of 40 people on a bus down to World Vision or any of the other opportunities to serve, it's a different environment than physically being here in Westminster. You learn all kinds of things driving down, because you've all chosen to do this thing with your Saturday. You learn all kinds of things when you're there working together. And the task isn't very sophisticated, it's fairly mechanical. But the discussions about what it means, where is this going, people in touch, all that's a very rich dialogue in many times with people that we didn't know. So to me, that's a real opportunity. It isn't that you're touching, well, But in the other rooms, you don't touch the one that you're serving.
Anyone else? And you were right, it was off. Sorry. Thoughts?
This coming Saturday, I think that we are aware of the fact that this is a challenge for us, that we here in our sort of suburban bubble don't have a lot of contact with people, as we've said before, who aren't like us. So we decided to try to do something about that. And Saturday, we're going to the seminary with three other churches, one of which is pretty much a black church, one is a mixed-race church, and one is, I think, college kids. So it's really a different group. And the discussion there will be, the discussion is about mass incarceration, which is a really important topic. But underneath that, or overlaying it, whichever, is the fact that we will be face-to-face for a day with people who are not like us. And our hope is that we will make a bond. And we are hoping to pledge ourselves to continue to have a connection after this is over so that we can learn more about the kinds of problems that we might not have here in Westminster, or at least not to the degree that people do in some of these inner city churches, but at least we can get to know, and I think it's the sort of share one another's burdens that we're looking for. And I don't think it happens by itself. I think we have to kind of stick our toe out there a little bit. And I guess I'm like we all are saying, if we start in the right direction, God will sort of push or carry us a little further, and then we'll get braver. And so that's what we're hoping. If anyone is interested in doing this, let Will or Jim know. We probably need to know by Wednesday because there's lunch at the seminary, and they need to know how many people, and we're trying to make small groups that are mixed well, so that we're not all of us Westminster people together, and, you know, each one in their own church group. So anyway, if you're interested, let Will know, or you can let me know and I can tell him, but he's the official registrar. Okay, so that's, sorry, I did an advertisement. But
all good. Any other thoughts that this raises for anybody?
I'm very hesitant to put this out, but because I don't know enough about it, but I'll put it out anyhow, since no one else has something at this point. Two weeks ago, I went to a lecture by a Muslim woman. I can't remember her full name, but it's Harsi Ali. She was born Muslim in Africa, and she actually ended up on Parliament in Netherlands. But she's an activist and a very prolific writer. And what she said, she said that in the Muslim religion, there are three groups. There, the group that follows Muhammad in his militaristic phase, and a group that follows Muhammad in his more peaceful phase, and then a group that tries to reform Muslimism. And she said something very frightening. She said that the Muslims in the Medina phase are committed to Sharia law, to changing everybody to become Muslim, and these are where people who are terrorists, you know, come from this group. And she said that she believes that that's the largest group. So I guess my comment is that when we speak about love of the other, love is not naive, love is not blind, love is wise. And so what we need is more of a spiritual discussion with Muslims to come to understand the faith and what is going on, so that instead of having fear of the unknown and not wanting to let Muslims come to this country because of the fact of terrorism, we need to understand and approach this whole thing with love and dialogue with Muslims to come to understand you know, how that fits in and how that feeds into our fear and our, what's that word for keeping people out, xenophobia or something. So I just throw that out.
Thanks, John.
Anybody else? Brian? No? Okay. Sarah?
Okay, I've got what I think is a tough one. How do we avoid condescension? And I think sometimes in churches, and I'm not naming this one, but you do see across the Christian spectrum condescension. You see behavior that's morally superior, lots of moralizing about the other, people who aren't like us and who are not as good as we are. You see the pious, kind of self-righteous discussions. You see people who are sanctimonious, even preachy. These are dangers, and I think you see that in the media, in Christianity, and in individual churches. Christine Pohl has a little story about this, and she calls it hospitality and power. And this is it. I witnessed a powerful expression of this phenomenon when I regularly attended a mission church. Although there was potential for some leadership from within the congregation, the resources almost always came from outside. One holiday season in particular, I watched with deepening dismay as waves of well-meaning suburban congregations came to the mission to help. They provided dinners, brought gifts, and led the worship programs. There was, in fact, nothing that the local congregation needed to do. Everyone assumed that the local people had nothing to offer. They became guests in their own church building, and despite the festive trimmings, disempowerment would be a generous description for what had happened.
Yeah, there are books written about this. One of them is Toxic Charity, that the Faith and Life group, I think we read that and discussed it. But what that book says is that description is a common outcome of what churches do, because they don't understand the disempowering part. And a number of the things Westminster is doing are directly designed, aimed at overcoming that.
Okay. Christine regards the deepest condescension may be expressed in a person's unwillingness to be a guest. Like in this situation, the suburban congregations were in control, and they were unwilling to be a guest of the people at the mission. And I think that's something that we try to avoid, but that's hard. I think it's really hard. And this is where humility comes in. I think humility is a key virtue for hospitality. And I guess human nature, it's hard. Bobby?
I don't want to monopolize, but I do have to tell the story about at the House of Manna, where in Homewood, where a number of people went. I guess we were going there about 2 years ago. Dan and Lois were the sort of forerunners of this. But in any case, I think it was my first time to go, and we had planned the food, and we took, you know, various dishes and set up the tables all in a row, and where the food was presented, and the people from that church were on the other side of the table, and we Westminster people were on opposite sides of the table, and we were standing there handing out the food, and then they took it and went and sat down. And after about 15 minutes of this, I don't know how many of you know Eugene Blackwell, but he's a big, forceful guy and who's the pastor of that group at the time. And he got on the microphone, turned down the music, and he said, "All right, all you white people," Homewood is, of course, black, "all right, all you white people, come back, come out from behind that table and talk to these folks." And it was so startling that, you know, we didn't have time to be offended in any way, and he was absolutely right. We were safely behind our table doing our prescribed job, so we really didn't have to integrate ourselves with the people who we had made into the guests and somehow maybe less than us. Anyway, that was kind of an eye-opener.
Well, Bobby, I have a similar story when our choir went down on the bus one of those nights, and we had dinner, and we were mixing pretty well, but like we were going to sing for these people who were really good musicians, and, you know, white people just can't sing in the style that we were trying to sing in, and it was so embarrassing. You know, they were very gracious, but it was just painful. It really, really was. Yeah, so we didn't go back.
I know those folks very well, and they didn't have anything like the reaction you did.
Well, they were very gracious.
No, but Lois and I went there many Fridays.
I know.
And they did not have, they welcomed you. They were delighted you came. They delighted you did what you did. No, that wasn't.
Well, but I know.
That's not their response.
They were very gracious and they were welcoming, but I think we probably should have chosen something that we, you know, really do sing well. That would be all I would say. Yeah. It was a great evening. We enjoyed it. Yeah.
So one thought that comes to mind, you mentioned, you know, whatever you do to the least of these, you've done to me. And I think there's a puzzle in that about how we regard our neighbor in it, because I always feel this little prick of discomfort when I hear those words, the least of these, because I say to myself, okay, so who is this person that I've identified as the least of them? And, you know, I'm wondering if anybody else has that discomfort with those words. But then when you reflect on the full passage, what Jesus is saying is that that person that you regard as the least of these is in fact me. You know, which is to say, no, they're not really the least of these. They are me. They are, you know, a child of God. Any thoughts about who is the least of these?
Well, I think you're right about we are the other is me. If you see the other as Jesus, as if Jesus is somebody distant, that's not getting what he means. We're all one in Christ, and the other is me, my other self. And do unto others as you would do unto yourself really means literally you are doing unto yourself if you do to the others. That's what the scripture I take means. But we tend to be dualistic about it. We always break things up into separate parts, them and us. There is no them and us. There's only we in the scripture.
Anyone else?
Well, I had the fortunate experience of being with families who had adopted Korean children and Chinese children, and they thought that they were doing this to the least of these, to the least of these children. And as the children grew up, the parents realized, oh my goodness, they are looking just like all the other Koreans, as if somehow they expected this child to be different than what the genetic observance on the outside would be. And the children, on the other hand, who had been adopted by Americans, came to the Korean church looking for some identity with children and people their age who looked just like them. The interesting thing was that the Korean children, who they thought that they were the least of those, because they couldn't speak Korean and they didn't have the attachment to the Korean culture. But as soon as they saw that the parents were much stricter in Korean culture than the Americans, they were very happy to go back home to their American parents. So there was a dichotomy of not only the identity of who was the least of these, but there was the attempt at developing their own identity. And I think that's part and parcel of who we are as we go someplace else or with other people. I know, you know, just if I go to, for example, the beauty parlor and I talk, well, how are your children? Where do they go? You know, do they go to nursery school? What happens to them? They're very surprised that I even care or whatever, or offer our nursery school to them. And so I think it's in our conversation with other people on an intimate basis that is really important.
Thank you. Someone else? Here's a promise if you haven't spoken. Thank you.
As I was thinking about this, we have to be aware that culture and understanding of culture plays such a big part of this whole process. When you think back, when people that came to this country and immigrated to this country for many, many years, they stuck in their own little groups. They had their own churches. They had their own social societies. I know my grandparents, they didn't socialize with anybody else. And you know, it's the fact of we have, you know, with the internet and everything now and the whole world being so accessible, we're much more aware of other cultures, but we need to educate ourselves about them too in order to be more, be able to integrate more. And thinking of the least of these, our son spent 2 or 3 months in Nepal a couple of years ago. And talk about the least of these, those people have nothing, but they are so happy. And they're so socially oriented. They're always doing things together. They, as the country's put, like pretty white, black and white with the snow and everything. But they, their villages are very colorful. Their clothes are very colorful. And if you weren't a part of that and understood that, you would never understand how these people could feel so good and be so happy with themselves, because we would think, oh, those poor people, they have nothing. So understanding culture is a big part of it.
Thank you, Marilyn. Anyone else? I promise if you haven't spoken yet and you crawl out on that limb, we will not cut it off.
A new topic?
Okay.
No, I meant anybody has a new topic. Yeah.
Since you're looking for someone to talk, a number of us meet every Wednesday night in what is called Faith in Life that Jim leads. And in our minds, Westminster, since Jim has come, has made enormous progress in this direction. And the way he puts it is there's many tributaries that are forming, and we've talked about some of them, and they include the seminars you did last summer, right, on race. And to me, the really cool thing about that is the attendance grew each week rather than on a provocative topic like that doing the opposite. And I think we have a real opportunity to do something important, not just for our church and those we serve, but we're becoming, because of all these things, a role model for other churches. And the seminaries using us as a role model, the presbyteries using us as a role model. And it isn't because we've made this enormous progress, but others are doing almost nothing. They talk a lot. Our faith tells us to do this. But there's a whole series of things going on, that, as Jim calls them, tributaries, that we have a real opportunity to fundamentally change who we are and be a role model for others.
Anyone else?
I think going off of that, and as well kind of going back to the theme of acts of hospitality, one metaphor would be that acts of hospitality are like building blocks. Individually, such as an individual events, they might not do that much by themselves. But when you put enough of them together, you can build something impressive. On the other hand, I was also just thinking, with carelessness, you can knock it all down by accident. So that's something to also consider.
Thank you. Anyone else? Howard? I see great thoughts emanating from your brain. Yes.
I would like to hear more about your work, especially in the city of Pittsburgh.
Tell us about what your experience is.
Yeah. We know people don't know their neighbors.
Tell a little bit about where you are and what the Leaderpop does.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do a little bit of both, maybe. First of all, just to back up to the original topic of hospitality, we, you know, Tom and Bobby experienced our community years ago when Jessica and I were young children. Actually, neither of us were probably on the community where they came, so we didn't really meet back then. But we know what they mean by what they experience. I would say that we are not experts on hospitality there. In fact, if I think back, the best hospitality I've experienced was in southern Appalachia, where my family landed back in the early 70s, where people would just welcome us in as if we were long-lost friends. And yeah, it was amazing. But in our community, we just try to look after all of our brothers and sisters by sharing everything in common. And in that way, because no one has more than the other, there is no one physically needy among us. But then the longing, as my wife probably mentioned, I'm not sure how much she said about it, but the longing was from our community was to just see where God is working in different cities, and for us to specifically here in Pittsburgh. And well, there's so many impressions we have. I hardly know where to start, but we definitely see a lot more good things happening than we had ever imagined. But I think the discussion that's going on today is even more important, that we see from where we are, what can we do, because we won't all have the opportunity to you know, welcome maybe a refugee into our home. But we definitely have the longing that as a city, we would do a better job of making these people really feel at home. Now, refugees aren't being settled in Fayette County, where our community is, so we have to be careful not to just say, come on, Pittsburgh, why don't you do better? Because we also see how much we fail on an individual basis, as I said earlier, and just reaching out to those who we don't know so well. But that's one thing we've noticed, and we just hope that we all find a way to make these people really feel included, not just provide for their physical needs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like Jeff says, our minds have just been, and hearts have been just really, really stretched. And it's just been such a privilege to have an opportunity given to us to have the time to meet, to get to know, to, you know, make new friendships, to learn. We've learned a lot. And
you said you were surprised. What are you surprised about?
Well, I would say we have been just surprised how many different tangents are going out from churches, from organizations, individuals who are trying to reach, you know, it's just such a wide spectrum of society that is somehow hurting or needing or, you know, not where we are, and whether it's in giving food, clothing, helping kids who have incarcerated parents, you know, the list goes on and on and on. And I'm not a city person, always grown up in the country, so for me, I think it's especially been an eye-opening experience and something I will never, ever forget. And needless to say, my prayers are really, really with everybody we have met, and, you know, just a wish that whatever they're doing is that they feel encouraged, that they keep going, that and for all of you, what you're doing, that you keep going and you know, don't get discouraged, and know that in our prayers we are behind what you're trying to do as well. And I have to honestly say that for me to walk into a place like Jubilee Kitchen, which you probably know, and for me to have the courage and also to pray, to have the love to walk out from behind that counter and meet, you know, those who are there, who are dirty, who are, you know, they smell, they obviously have spent nights out on the street, and your first impression is like, oh, how can I, you know? But yet, to see Christ right there, to me, that's been a very, it's touched me and it's challenged me to think, you know, here I have that opportunity to spend time to show love, to show compassion, to hear them, to sit and hear them, you know, even if everything they're saying is just, you know, frustration, but just to have the patience and the love and compassion to sit and hear them. And
as you do it, does it get a little easier?
It does. Yes, it does. Definitely does. Yes. Yep. And it, like some others have said, it takes courage. And, you know, you feel it's a risk. Although I hate to say that, but to be honest, and even with the contact that we've had with some of the refugee families, you know, we've been to many of the some of the homes where they live, and they are not in good neighborhoods, and that has taken courage to go there but when we've entered their homes, they're just so welcoming and, you know, treat us like kings and queens. I mean, we just feel so humbled entering their homes, and they're used to so little, like the lady in front of us was saying, you know, these people from the Congo, we've got to know a family, and they're used to cooking on a wood fire. They've been in a refugee camp for 20 years, and yet, despite all the hurdles and the frustrations and the difficulties of getting to know the life here, their new life in Pittsburgh, they just radiate this joy and eagerness to find work, to share their culture. And, you know, Jeff and I went twice to this one home, and here we were. Never would have thought this would ever happen. But, you know, first of all, we were eating their African food, and then we asked them, what do you do after your dinner? And, we dance. And then the dad got up, and he started dancing around, and we just felt we need to join them. We need to be right there with them. And there we were on the floor dancing around, doing our best, you know. But we just felt so enriched, so enriched. And here these people have nothing. You know, materially, they have nothing, but yet within them, they are so rich. And that's something that, you know, we will never forget. And as a couple, you know, with our six children, it will make a difference how our lives continue. You know, in what we have in our home, how we use our time, how we depend on the good Lord for giving us strength to do whatever He wants us to do, it will make a difference. So it's probably very disconnected, but that's just some things that are going through my mind.
Can I make a brief comment? So Jessica is telling us that the rich are poor and the poor are rich. And somehow extending ourselves, if we're the rich, we can find how we're really, what real riches are.
I think the key to what you said was you were the guest in your humility, and they were showing the hospitality, and you were willing to take the risk, and you weren't judgmental or whatever. And that, I think that's the message that we're trying to get at. So thank you.
Failing battery.
Okay, is it on now? Okay. John, to your point, the more I do this, the more I believe all the stuff we have gets in the way of us feeling like you did in this home you went to, or and the people that don't have anything like in DePaul, they don't have that stuff to get in the way. And of course, our faith tells us that, doesn't it? This is just a real life example.
Okay, I feel brilliant thoughts floating in the room that have not come out yet. And so I'd love to hear, we have about 3 more minutes, I'd love to hear something from somebody who hasn't said anything yet. What's on your mind? Save me. I'm here with dead air. Lois gets to go first.
Just one of the things, like showing them hospitality. Dan and I served meals down in Homewood for a couple years, and we got to know the people personally, and I don't think they realized how important they were to us. But the one time there was a man, he used to come through the line every week and every week, and he wasn't there for a couple weeks. And when he came back, I said to him, I said, "Where have you been? I've missed you." He sobbed. He says, "Nobody has ever missed me before. Nobody has ever said that to me." And it just made it feel, you know, how important, you know, we are to them and they are to us.
Well, so something Lois isn't saying is, over the time we spent at House of Manna, she became the welcomer at the door. And she knew all their names, and they welcomed her. So joining in their world is doable. And like you experienced, it's very rewarding if you just take those initial steps.
There's a cone of silence on this side of the room. Almost. Anyone?
I think it helps also
also if you've had experiences in your own life of feeling poor or feeling rich. And if you have had those experiences in your own life where you haven't been able to do or buy or be, I mean, I always wore secondhand clothes as a child. I felt like the poorest one of our family among all our relatives. I think when you walk that road in your lifetime and have those experiences, it may lead to two things. It may lead to a sense of depression and a sense of not doing anything, or it leads to motivation to do everything you possibly can and to live life with all the potential that you have in whatever area God has graced you with. So it helps to have had and walked both paths in your life experiences.
Thank you very much. I think that will be our last word, but for Sarah to talk about what comes next.
Yeah. Please come back next week. We need to welcome a fairly sort of new professor from Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, Roger Owens. He's another Methodist. We like Methodists around here. Jim Gilchrist, our pastor, grew up half Presbyterian and half Methodist. So it's sort of a standing joke around here. But his Lenten series is going to be about how all we need to listen to God is Scripture and how to read it to find God, not for information, but as a spiritual tool. So I hope you'll come back. Thanks.